Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
My name is Catherine Newmark and in today's program we will discuss a radical idea. Now you may think that we live in times that are prone to all sorts of radicalisms, politically polarized as we are. So you may actually believe political radicalism to present a danger to liberal democracy. My guest today, however, has something else in mind when he uses the word radical. Omri Böhm is an Israeli philosopher, a professor at the New School for Social Research in New York, and the author of books and articles both on early modern philosophy and on current politics. His last book was published under the title Israel, eine Utopie in German and as Haifa Republic, a Democratic Future for Israel in English. His newest book, that will be out next week in German, is called Radikaler Universalismus, Jenseits von Identität. And what he means by radical universalism is what I will ask him in the coming half hour or so. Omri Böhm, I am delighted that you could join us. Welcome to the program.
Delighted to talk to you again.
Now, Omri, your book is a very philosophical and as such theoretical book, but it is also a very political book, at least indirectly. So I think before we delve into the deeper philosophical claims that you make about universalism and the radicalism thereof, we should start with setting out the political and philosophical landscape within which you make these claims, which to an extent one could say are hinted at in the subtitle, Jenseits von Identität, beyond identity. What is it in the current moment that leads you to think about universalism? Or to ask the question somewhat more provocatively, are you joining the ranks of those who like to bash the so-called identity politics of the left?
Right, exactly. So that's very much a question that I've expected, and of course I've been aware of it while writing the book, and the answer is yes and no. On the one hand, I'm not part of the identity politics trend. On the other hand, I'm not interested in joining the bashing of identity politics. I think that a lot of the motivations, many of them, of the so-called identity politics, it's also a Kampfbegriff, right? And that's also a reason why I don't always like using it, even though I think it should be used because it signals a certain fashion, a certain mode of doing politics. We can talk about that. I think that a certain motivation of disorganante identity politics needs to be preserved, but also harshly criticized. I think that also a lot of the things that identity politicians accuse liberal democracy of is often accurate. We can talk about that. Only that I think it needs to be framed precisely through the lenses of accusing some of the alleged liberals in the center of themselves doing identity politics. So the reason why the book is called Beyond Identity is precisely that I think both sides of this debate, bashing each other, are actually hostages of the concept of identity that emerged because universalism no longer fulfilled what it had to fulfill. So you have the identity of the people on the center, and it usually maintains authority. I think that's an important term here, especially if we are to speak philosophy. And there's the identity of the people who now go against the liberal center. Both sides here are arguing in the name of identity. What my book tries to do, and if you're careful, which I know you are, you will have noticed that I speak about beyond identity, but not beyond identity politics, precisely because I don't want to make this a bashing of identity politics. It is beyond identity because I want to go beyond the identity of the center, beyond the identity of the left. I want to try to recover an idea of universalism that precisely does not begin with identity.
So I noticed that you're talking about two sides, the sort of leftist identity politics and the liberal center. Of course, one could also add a third side, which would be right-wing identity politics.
Important, yes.
If one wanted to complete this picture, but let's maybe come straight to the claim or to this sort of main concept that you try to sort of build in opposition to all these different types of identities, which I'm sure you will describe somewhat more in depth in a moment. Universalism has been under attack for a long time for different reasons. There is, of course, something like the liberal center who to some degree still defends it, but not, I think, in the way you understand it. And it has gotten very concretely and very recently a particularly bad reputation, especially among what one could call progressive leftist thought, where the universalism of the Enlightenment, the humanism that we often see as a model of universalism, has been actually critiqued as not universalism at all, but as a identity politics for white, Western, European men in particular. So
that's right.
There is actually, and this is one of the claims that is forwarded, no actual universalist project. There are only particularist interests, colonialist interests at that. What do you answer to this claim? Or is this is sort of, I think, the center of something that you want to reject, right?
That's correct. I want to reject it, but I don't want to reject it by just bashing it. I think that a lot of this count, a lot of this criticism is accurate. In order to save universalism, we need to understand the parts of this claim that are true and the parts of this claim that are not in order to defend true universalism as opposed to false universalism. Look, you know, when I chose a title for this book, you know, I called it Radical Universalism, and someone told me correctly, actually it's redundant, because if I understand you correctly, you want to say that universalism worthy of the name is always radical. There is no such a thing as moderate universalism, and this is true. We can talk about it in a moment. The point is, my view is, and I try to spell it out in the book, that once the Enlightenment has actually undermined universalism, it gave the first accounts of identity politics replacing universalism. The Enlightenment, in many ways, is remembered today as the movement that produced and encouraged universalism, and to some extent it is true. But in another extent, and I spell this out in the book as a philosophical argument, we can talk about this, it is actually the movement that undermined universalism. And once universalism was undermined, what took over was identity, by all means, very much the identity of white European men. So the question of saving universalism needs to be saving universalism from the Enlightenment, or saving universalism from some strands of the Enlightenment that were very powerful and that both philosophically and politically took over the Enlightenment project. The main argument of the book is that we need to identify this, we need to see this clearly. And once we see this clearly, we can also see that there was this philosopher that some of us have heard of, Immanuel Kant, who has noticed the same problem at the heart of the Enlightenment tradition and was trying to articulate the response to it. So trying to recover the genuine universalist trends, as opposed to the strands of the Enlightenment that actually undermine universalism and give rise to the identity politics of white men. I take it some people on the identitarian left today, I don't always like using even those terms because they have become Kampfbegriffe, at least partly. The argument is that universalism itself is identity politics for white men. I think this is false. I think that it is a corruption of universalism, by all means through the Enlightenment principles and through Enlightenment rationalism even sometimes. It is through that that we have received identity politics for white men. The attempt needs to be to redeem universalism itself from this trend.
So as to regain a category that can actually go beyond identity, yes, as a claim. So if you're already talking about that, then maybe you could describe, and I mean, you do this in different and very interesting to read and very convincing ways in your book, but what is sort of in broad strokes the corruption of a universal ideal that you see in the Enlightenment, and what is sort of the way to save it?
Yes, I guess in the most general terms, the corruption of true universalism through the Enlightenment came about through the corruption of the concept of humanity. At some point, the authority of humanism, of the value of being human, was important to the Enlightenment. But once the Enlightenment made everything natural and attached all value to nature and to what can be known by nature and what can be known by science, the concept of humanity was reduced to the merely biological. The problem is that given our Enlightenment concept of biology, we also cannot attach any value or meaning to biological facts. So humanity stopped playing an anchor of value. can think of a statement like, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they were endowed by their creator with inalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, you can ask yourself as a philosopher, you ask yourself, okay, if those are self-evident truths of universal humanism, what grounds them? God is no good. I don't think we need to argue about that here, even though I'm prepared to do that if we should. God is not going to be the anchor of those self-evident truths. The Enlightenment at first went to nature, right? We all know the concept of natural rights. Mm-hmm. As human beings, from nature, we have those rights. The problem is that once the Enlightenment gave us its mature concept of nature, the reduction of humans to nature and of rights to natural rights is no longer convincing. Not only it's not convincing, not only does not ground natural rights, it cancels them. Because we positively know that nature gives us no rights. Nature is blind. And to think that nature is not blind is to contradict science. So the question arises at that moment, what do you do about the value of humans? Do you treat them as natural beings that are to be mastered and possessed like the rest of nature? That's the way in which you get also colonialism and enslavement and so forth. Power becomes the main category, and those who have the power also to colonize, exploit, and expel use it in order to be, again, the masters and possessors of nature, including of humans within it. The question is that the response? Is that the end result of enlightenment? If yes, then we've received, in a way, identity politics, because we get here the identity of power. Those who can, in the name of their own interest, use their power, they are the ones who will determine what will happen. To the extent that that trend then articulates also the concept of what universalism is, while exploiting other people, other nations, and other genders, and so forth, you get identity politics straight out of the Enlightenment because it has undermined universalism. The question is whether from within the commitment to the Enlightenment's concept of reason, we can still save the value of humanity without going straight to religion on the one side, without reducing human beings to natural beings that are to be studied by science, but remain again true to two conditions, really. One is being rational, such that the value that we explain is rational. That's why it's consistent with the Enlightenment. The second is that we're still talking about value and not about facts. And that is what I take to be the motivation of Immanuel Kant, that is, for that reason, so burning for us today.
So if I understand this correctly, if we do truly want to have something like universal values, a universal standard by which we can sort of create something like justice, God doesn't work because religions are particular and intolerant and nature tends to be blind, and all we are left with is the will to power that sort of becomes a nihilism. We are sort of somewhere between Spinoza and Nietzsche, but it for sure doesn't give us any good grounding for morals. Now, what is Kant's solution, if you could sort of very broadly just give us the outline of why Kant is such a central figure for you in this endeavor to reestablish universalism?
What Kant did, the Kantian maneuver, was twofold. What I'm saying is relatively familiar to the experts, but what I'm trying to do in the book is to really spell out how relevant and how important it is for us today, precisely as an answer to our predicament with identity. The movement was twofold. First, to limit science and to show that the authority of science can only be defended if it is limited. If you will try to make science the authority over truth all across the board, the authority of science itself collapses. So that's the first part of the project. It's most obvious in the Critique of Pure Reason, where science measures natural facts, but natural facts cannot be taken to be the description of everything because they are only the descriptions of the world as it appears. This leaves room for what is beyond nature, and that's the realm of freedom. The big Kantian maneuver is to insist that the concept of humanity, cannot be understood as a natural concept at all. If you're trying to understand human beings as animals, you didn't get what humanity is. If your reduction of humans to natural beings is successful, what you did is not showing that human beings are natural beings. You rather showed that human beings do not exist. The concept of being human can only be thought of as a moral category rather than as a natural category. To be human is to be open to the demands of freedom, which for Kant are always the demands of being open to following the moral law. Now, this is now getting complicated for a short conversation. But if this maneuver is successful, then that is a big difference that Kant has to offer to the development of enlightenment. To save, to rescue, by the way, 100 years before Darwin, to rescue the concept of humanity from its reduction back to nature. If we can still preserve this motivation today, then I think that we have a lot we can work on beyond identity. The point is, once you reduce human beings to nature, you've done at least two things. First, you've shown that they do not have some kind of an absolute value as human beings who ought to be respected and cannot be humiliated. The idea that you ought to treat human beings always as ends, never as means, is something that once you've reduced them to nature, has been completely canceled. Once you reduce human beings to nature, human beings can, in fact, be treated as means, like the rest of nature. In any case, you will not be able to say what's wrong with that. The second thing that you've done is you've reduced human beings to their identity. And the reason is that once you reduced them to nature, you reduced them to facts about them. And facts are what determines their identity. The combination of this reduction of humans to their identity, to being black, to being white, to being Jewish, to being male or female, and so forth, combined with the idea that human beings can be used because they're not a special category that holds worth, gives you a history of exploitation, a history of enslavement, a history of expulsion. The claim that it is this Kantian attempt to defend universalism from the reduction of human beings to nature is itself the colonialist way to reduce them, I think is intellectually bankrupt, false, and dangerous, because it actually participates in the type of ideology that actually allows for colonialism, exploitation. But the identitarian left has this actually together with many, if not most, thinkers in the liberal center, because the one thing that's common for them today is that they reject the Kantian inheritance of defending humanism in strong metaphysical terms of the sort that I just mentioned.
And I think at this point one can probably easily come to the two sort of follow-up questions that I have to this, because I think that the liberal center has a different reason possibly to the sort of critical left to reject this. I mean, there's two things that come out of this. I mean, first of all, how do we deal with Kant, who was obviously in his private life, like many people of the era, a sexist, you know, said things that one shouldn't say nowadays about women, but also obviously about the so-called races of the human being. That is often used as an argument to sort of say he's undermining his own universalism and the universalism is thus not valid. I think that would be the criticism of the left, which I think we need to address. And I think possibly philosophically more complicated even is what I would consider sort of a liberal centrist problem is, should we really be basing our ethics and our morals on metaphysics? Metaphysics are not an easy, it's not something you would put with a very light heart into your shopping cart, your intellectual one.
That's right. So let's go first for the first challenge from the left. That Kant expressed racist remarks, misogynist remarks, and so anti-Semitic remarks is not controversial. He obviously held those views and expressed them, partly even in his theoretical writings, even though not quite his philosophical writings. And here I actually think that there is a distinction that's significant and that is sometimes challenged, but I think not with convincing grounds. If one understands Kant's philosophy and precisely understands that the value of human beings cannot be attached to any facts about them, then one understands precisely why Kantian anthropology, to the extent that he had an anthropology and that as part of this anthropology he held racist views, that this anthropology is not and cannot be relevant to Kantian ethics. It cannot be relevant precisely because, if you understand what Kant's whole maneuver is about, facts about human beings, empirical science about human beings, cannot determine the worth of human beings. That was a big Kantian achievement. And so not only Kant's private opinions, he's dead now, not even his views in anthropology can be relevant to the ethical position. Why is this important? It is important because it actually requires being politically correct in order to assume that we will never discover that, I don't know what, that facts about some people can actually determine their intelligence. The question whether science can uphold or refute the idea that human beings have absolute worth is itself already assuming that human beings do not have this worth. Because if science, that is knowledge of nature, is to have the authority over the worth of human beings, this means that human beings are natural beings that can be known in a certain way, and for that reason, they do not have this worth. This worth is absolute, and for that reason, cannot be known through the methods, empirical methods of science. For that reason, I'm not impressed with the fact that Kant was a racist. The man, the dead white man Kant, was a racist. I'm not impressed with that.
And
I'm more impressed, by the way, with the fact that so many people on the left are willing to really spill the baby with the water and reduce human beings to beings that actually maybe can be used because they are natural beings. Again, they're in good company with a lot of post-metaphysical centrists.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to defend today the other view.
Which brings us to this metaphysics question, which is really not that easy to answer, right?
It probably is easy for you,
but for me it is counterintuitive that we should go back to metaphysics to the point that you suggest.
It is not easy to answer, but I think we now see the price of not answering it, because the price is falling back on identity. If what replaces metaphysics is identity, then we have a problem, and I think we know it. You mentioned before, you know, when I sketched the map of the identitarian left and the center, which pretends to be universalistic but is actually identitarian itself, you actually were very correct to point out to me that there is also a third, and that's the identitarian right, which we see rising. We see now the price of not having an answer to identity, not being able to explain what's wrong with it. So the first thing that I want to do is to put a price tag on the claim that metaphysics is dangerous. Metaphysics is dangerous and identity is dangerous. Both of them are dangerous. The question is what we are to do about this and whether we can take a certain form of metaphysics as right. As you know, Kant is not doing old school metaphysics like Plato, Aristotle, or Descartes or Spinoza. So we're not going to ground our politics in metaphysics in that sense. On a first pass, the question is whether we can ground our politics in certain truths that we're going to also take as hardcore truths, that we can defend them as consistent with our rationalism and with certain ultimate values that cannot be violated. The point is the following. I think that the truths that I'm going to state as those truths, they're not going to be that controversial in the center and the left, I hope. On the right, we'll have to see. The question whether we will treat them as metaphysical propositions will have a different significance. Not whether we agree that they are true or not, but whether we agree about their authority. The idea that all human beings are equal requires a metaphysics. Without a metaphysics, that statement is actually not true, cannot be grounded. Maybe it's a religious faith, maybe it's some kind of a myth that we like to tell our children before they go to bed or something like that. The main question of metaphysics that I try to raise in my book is whether we can take that proposition. I take it you are not going to deny it, and I take it not many people are going to now jump in the air and say, oh, but I deny it. We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men, and we can also talk about this man, that all men are created equal. That requires a metaphysical proposition in order to assume authority over the type of politics that we adopt. In fact, the struggle of my book is to defend that as a proposition that has authority, and has authority in the sense that we do not muddy the water, we do not water down our politics when our interests are jeopardized by the fact that we have to confront it. For example, we know cases from history, older and more recent, where people who followed this proposition followed it hypocritically, because once it came to the question of their own position, they preferred to prefer their own interests and their own identity. The question is whether we can say that that cannot be done, because the truth of equality has authority.
Now, if we sort of come back from this sort of relatively high metaphysical heights, which are complicated, and I'm not sure there is a sort of place to go into sort of, or let's say it will take us into a very sort of speculative realms at some point if we continue this down this path. Let's come back to sort of more sort of grounded things that are politically relevant. I mean, there's a few questions that follow for me also practically from this. I mean, the one thing that I still would like to hear from you is, in which sense is the liberal center that you construe as sort of opposed to the progressive left itself identitarian or concerned with identity politics? Because we would generally say those tend to be the people who do defend maybe not something universal, but something common, a common ground, something bigger than group identities. In which sense are they themselves identitarian?
Great. This is probably the most important political question of the book. They are identitarian because they begin their politics with the concept of the we. And they call this we universal. And that's precisely the moment in which the identitarian left is correct to say, oh, your universalism is identity politics for white men, because the people who get to say we in politics are always, by definition, the people who have the power to say it. Say, we all are, you're already saying, we all who belong, right? African Americans, enslaved African Americans did not belong to the American we. Jews did not belong to the German we. Palestinians do not belong to the Israeli, not to say the Jewish we. The question whether the we begins our politics, or rather a real universal concept of humanity that has a greater authority than this dear we, is the main question whether the liberal center is identitarian or not. And today, the forms of liberalism that we know, they all fall back on the we. That is, I think, obvious when we consider the examples. The question whether we can have a concept of liberal democracy that is actually not we liberalism. I show in the book how this we liberalism is basically the inheritance of the unionists from the days before the American Civil War. There was this clash between the abolitionists and the unionists. We liberals are the followers, basically, of the unionists, the ones who said, we Americans, all of us Americans, need to preserve the rule of law, only that this rule of law was not so good to, 3 million slaves who were, raped, enslaved, murdered, sold and bought. But there was a we liberalism. The abolitionists were the ones who said, we need to act in order to preserve the value of humanity, even if this means we need to go against the Constitution, because there is something that's higher than the Constitution, and that's the truth, that all men are created equal. The question whether a certain abolitionist tradition can be preserved is among the questions behind this book, precisely because I do not believe that an identitarian left, to the extent that it has given up on universalism, can preserve this abolitionist tradition. An abolitionist tradition would be one that does not begin with a we, that does not begin with identity, but rather begins with a certain duty to humanity. That is the main difference. Since I just criticized the identitarian left, I should also mention those people who say, all of us, we Americans, and so forth, and then also attach to this the adjective universalism. Those are not just the ones who have the power in politics. They also have the power in philosophy. That is the power over thinking and knowledge. They get to determine their identity and to claim that their identity is universalist. I agree with this identitarian left criticism of the liberal center, to the extent that those critics of identity politics say, but we liberalism, and that is universalism. That is really the worst corruption of the concept of universalism, and this is what I'm trying to go against.
Because any universalism that uses the word we, that sort of defines a group, is by sort of definition not universal. It is just a question of how large or small you define that group. And this is, of course, the history of liberal democracies in the West, that they started with defining the group as somewhat small and enlarged it sort of successively without ever having a real universal claim. Now, if I may just sort of come to some, from all this extremely convincing and beautifully laid out philosophical account that you give, there is a lot in your book that bears on the US-American history and its histories of sort of racism and anti-racism. So it is not merely a philosophical book. It also does show quite a lot of sort of historical richness. But at the same time, there is something very philosophical about it insofar as you as a philosopher do seem to believe that philosophy matters. Now,
that's right.
I am not against this thought or this claim, but I would yet, even in however beautifully put, however convincingly spread out, this push to reestablish universalism as the category which we need to usefully criticize racism or whichever other sort of discriminatory practices, could not a person in the political scene say, well, philosophically this may be true, but on the ground right now, I am not interested in a sort of an abstract idea, abstract metaphysical idea of human dignity and humanity as freedom defined by Kant. I am just interested in criticizing here and now in equal sort of treatment of black people or of women or of whatever category you may use in this instance. And the philosophical background does not really have any bearing on my politics. This sounds primitive, but to a certain degree, I worry that the philosopher may not be heard, even if he is right in analyzing the sort of intellectual and conceptual motives in the political movements. The political movements might simply not care.
I think the political movements care, but there are maybe two different levels here, at least, I'm sure there are much more, but at least two different levels of discussion. One is really the person on the street, who may not at a certain concrete moment, definitely not when she's being attacked, definitely not when he's being shot at, definitely not when, if they cannot feed their children, that they do not care about theory. And obviously, at that point, they don't. To those people, say if they go on the street out to a demonstration, let me know. I'm prepared to consider seriously joining them. To that extent also, they do not go around. If they don't care about theory, they don't need me. They also don't need critical race, and they don't need post-colonialism, and so on and so forth. They go on the street, they go and have a certain political struggle, and I may well be with them. For example, I was most of the time not a critic of Black Lives Matter in the U.S., most of the time. But as you know, there is a growing trend of making an assumption that actually contradicts yours, which is to say, look, in order to finally overcome the injustices also of the here and now, we need to decolonize our thinking. Mm-hmm. We need to have actually a change of thought. And on a first pass, I want to first agree with that proposition. Maybe it's because I'm what Nietzsche once called the proudest of all animals and the stupidest, namely the philosopher. But because maybe it's because I'm a philosopher, maybe not. I actually believe that human beings live in their thoughts and in the truth that they assume. And for that reason, in order to have serious political changes, changes of thinking have to take place. And the question is whether the changes of thinking are going to be ones for the better or for the worse. So that's something that I assume with the critics of Enlightenment, with the critics of Kant, with the critics of universalism. If we are to go to the next time when people speak about post-colonialism and say, actually, who cares about post-colonialism? This is a theory. You need to stand on the ground and fight against colonialism. It will be also to some extent true and to some extent not true. I think that it's true, and that I share with post-colonialists and with critical race theorists, I think it's true that in order to have the significant changes that we must have to our society in relation to women, in relation to men, in relation to class, in relation to the so-called global south, a term that I dislike, Palestinians, African Americans, gay people, and so forth, that in order to have those changes, we also need to change our thinking. What I disagree about is that the change of thinking we need is that what we need to do is to go to what some people take to be the head of colonialist thinking, which is universalism itself. I think it's precisely the other way around. In order to enable a certain abolitionist tradition, the abolitionist tradition, I remind you, the abolitionist tradition is a tradition that keeps the Declaration of Independence of the United States. Mm-hmm. In order to keep that tradition as a radical one, we actually need to preserve the concept of universalism. That's my claim. If in the process of revolting against the injustices today, and we are experiencing a revolution, we will also undermine universalism, then I think that we will lose, because we will lose the reason for which we are supposed to fight. So yes, I spoke too long and too much, but to try to give brief answers to this, to the extent that the person on the street does not require theory, it's true, they don't require theory. To the extent that our thinking matters in order to change politics, the question whether we get it right when we think about what needs to change is extremely significant.
Then maybe just briefly, because we're nearing the end of our conversation, your book develops a lot of its argument in the American context from the Declaration of Independence with these truths, which is sort of the metaphysical grounding of rights, to the Civil War, the anti-slavery movement, the anti-racism, and your sort of critical engagement with anti-racist movements is also partly expressed there, or there is a part that bears on that. I wonder, though, if with your engaging with this hot button issue is to a certain degree also avoiding to speak about the other really hot button issue that is very hot button in Germany these days, which is, of course, the issue of identity and identitarian politics in Zionism and in anti-Semitism and anti-anti-Semitism and post-colonialism, which is something you have also written about quite extensively in newspaper articles, especially in Germany. You mention it a tiny bit at the very end of your book, and of course, you have written a whole book on Zionism and the utopian potentials it may still have. Your last book was about that. But if you just sort of apply what you these insights that you have given us here about identity politics to this larger German debate that we are having right now, which you also engaged in the whole scandal about the Documenta in Kassel, anti-Semitism, and so on, how would it apply to our current fights about these topics here in Germany?
Yeah, well, firstly, you got me, you're right. I almost tried to avoid it deliberately because, you know, I've said what I have to say about Israel. I did say and I will say, I didn't want this book to be hijacked or reduced to yet another debate about Israel, but rather to have a certain principled philosophical and historical, but philosophical question about universalism posed. And for that reason, it goes to philosophy and it goes to America, which is a very symbolic moment. Unlike Israel, even though Israel plays here an important role as well, because Israel is probably the clearest example of the possibility of universalism after Auschwitz, right? To locate the question of universalism and identity in the book to my position on Israel is not difficult. I'm not making a secret of it. Far from it. It's relatively easy, and I will do it like that. I will say, well, Zionism is identity politics. It is identity politics that is justified, if identity politics ever was justified, and it is as justified as identity politics can be. What is the argument of the Zionists in the end? The argument is liberal democracy did not save us. It did not save our lives. It did not save our rights. In fact, in many ways, it attacked them. And that's precisely the point. Universalism is maybe good for Protestant or Christian, quote-unquote, white Europeans. It is not good for the Jews because it did not save them. We need our own politics. And if you criticize us, If you criticize us for insisting on our own identity politics and you do not belong to us, you're racist, anti-Semitic, because you cannot share our experience of persecution and so forth. So that's really the mother of identity politics. And we know also the limits of this argument, and we see how schief it can ultimately go.
Mm-hmm.
The liberal Zionist alternatives that we know from liberal Zionist philosophers, Avishai Margalit, Moshe Halbertal, Michael Walzer, you know, a whole Yuli Tamir, a whole tradition of liberal Zionist philosophers pretending to be universalists because liberals, they all do precisely this. They begin their concept of universalism with a we Jews. And once we go out of this concept, we see how we also manage to fit in within ourselves or to allow without the rights for the Palestinians who happen to be the majority in the territory that Israel controls. That seems to me very much an example of what it means to have a form of identity politics, obviously, and to call it universalist, but to use the power that you have to speak as a universalist in order to colonize. The book that I wrote about Israel was precisely the attempt to do the opposite, precisely to do this maneuver that I try theoretically in this new book to theoretically explain, to have the we in the end rather than in the beginning. To begin with the concept of the authority of the equality of all humans, this authority that is more important also from the German sensitivities to their past, also more important than some of the fears of the Jews, even though those fears also can be legitimate and important and need to be addressed. That is addressed in the book. There are chapters about memory. But to do all that were the absolute commitment, no negotiation on that, to the full equality of Jews and Palestinians is a beginning, and the concept of the we is in the end.
That was your application to the debate about Zionism. And I think in a recent, very interesting article that you wrote about the Documenta in Kassel, you also made the claim, which I found very convincing, that in a way, both sides or all sides in this argument are in many ways caught up in identity politics, in identity constructions that do not allow them to interact with each other meaningfully. And in that sense, maybe possibly the metaphysical absolute would help us to sort of get out of the klein-klein of the political fights. That would be the hope in a sense, right?
That's correct. I made no secret also of my criticism, not just of Documenta. I think that the fact that some of the things that were exhibited in Documenta need to be harshly criticized is not controversial. I made no secret not just of that. That's the easy part. The more difficult part, the more difficult question is the question of the relation of this Documenta to post-colonialism and to identity within it and how to go about that. On the one hand, an extremely important project, despite what so many people said, obviously need not be inherently anti-Semitic. I think that it's mind-boggling that people can make that proposition. However, things ended badly, and to my taste, they did also look badly even before they just exploded, precisely because of some of the tendencies that are anti-universalistic. And for that reason, endanger also, not only, but also anti-Semitism. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the German relation was all haunted by German identity. If Germans do not understand that, the Germans who do not see that are blind. If the Germans who think that the way they went about Documenta, the way they went about relating to those anti-Semitic images, the way they went about whether Israeli artists were or were not invited, was not a reflection of their own identity, then they're being either lying to others or lying to themselves. Obviously, it's all about German identity, and to a certain degree, this is good. I don't think that Germans should say, we're all just human beings, so we should not care about, we should not be sensitive to Jews. Of course, Germans should be. However, they should also understand that there are authorities beyond just being German. In fact, not understanding that is, among other things, what gave us the Holocaust, the understanding that there has to be a certain significance of universalism and the value of humanity beyond German identity, whether people think they now get German identity right as opposed to back then. That's very much the question of this documenta, whether Germany can actually do the same, have a certain concept of citizenship where the we is in the end, not in the beginning. This is very complex. It's complex in Germany for excellent reasons. I don't think that Germans, again, should be just naive and just allow everything. In my experience, you know, talking, say, to Weltoffenheit people, this is not what's being done. But we need also to allow ourselves to accept narratives that are not the German in order to be able to put the we in the end and not the we in the beginning. The danger that this will become anti-Semitic is rubbish, because universalism and the equality of all human beings is not anti-Semitic, but a lot of Zionists and a lot of anti-Deutsch people are the ones actually making that claim, very much like the post-colonialists. Universalism is anti-Semitic because it is universalism that opposes Zionism. It is universalism that opposes the rights of the Jews to their own state and so on and so forth. So we're back a full circle with this unity, actually, of the Zionists and the post-colonialists, both basically saying, well, if you're a universalist, then you're anti-Semitic on the one side. If you're a universalist, you're racist on the other side. And now let's see who has the power. In this game of power, at least in the medium, I don't know about the long run, but in the immediate and not so immediate run, Israel will have the power. That's not the type of politics that's worthy of universalism, also not of a Jewish inheritance, the way I understand it, and not as a citizen.
A very impressive plaidoyer for universalism, your book. I highly recommend to read it. Thank you, Omri Böhm, very much for these insights and for your time.
Thank you very much.
And Omri Böhm's book will be out next week. It is called Radikaler Universalismus jenseits von Identität and is published by the Populären Verlag.